supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna. This is Common Space. We asked three teachers to meet up in the studio at WHYY to talk about why they teach. They're very different in their approach toward teaching college now in that itinerant schedule that takes adjuncts from one college to another, commuting and accumulating miles. But when it comes to their memories of teachers they liked and those who had a negative impact on them, they are ready to talk about what shaped them the most. Joining us is Donald Dealey, an adjunct professor at Temple University and Moore College of Art and Design, where he teaches first-year writing and creative writing. We have Paul Arendt, adjunct professor at three colleges in Pennsylvania and Delaware, one of those commuting professors. And then Marjorie Winther is a veteran Chicago teacher who retired and is now running the corporate training department for Philadelphia's Gas Works. She's a regular storyteller at the First Person Art Slams. I started our conversation by asking her what makes a good teacher.
That's very easy, because the man I eventually married was the best teacher I'd ever seen in my life. And he didn't have a lot of charisma. He wasn't outgoing, particularly, very analytical. But he believed in his bones. I mean, it wasn't even something we say, I believe in this or that. It just was that the kids could learn, the kids would learn. And he went through life with that as his core understanding of the world. And everything he did made that happen. He set up his classroom with different stations. So if you were a real hands-on kid, you could do the hands-on part first. If you needed an informal space, there were beanbag chairs. He had even the questions from the book taped all around the room. And he'd have the kids who liked to write them and tape them. So instead of sit at your desk to answer the questions, you'd be walking around the room. Kids loved being there. They learned things. They thought about them. Years later, he'd have a kid come up to him, Mr. Winter, remember what you said about relativity? I mean, they would think about these things. And well, that's one of the reasons I married him. He just blew my mind. There's a story I thought of. It kind of answers your question. I was teaching high school chemistry, and there was a kid, and he was just kind of a big, goofy, he couldn't sit still. He was always jumping around, and he always came early, and he's like, you know what, Miss Winter, I can't really read the book. I really have to do stuff. And I said, well, Marcus, his name was, it sounds like you're a tactile kinesthetic learner. He's like, I'm what? Tactile kinesthetic. And he looked at me, he got up, I had big blackboards all across the front, and he started writing these huge letters, I mean, as high as he could reach, all the way down. He started writing tactile kinesthetic. And he did that every day for about a week. And it's such a tactile kinesthetic way of processing that information. But I think why he owned it so deeply was that he'd been told all his life, you're acting silly, sit down. And I was telling him, don't sit down. This is who you are. This is someone who's going to learn by doing things. This is someone who will probably do very well in any kind of work with his hands. He could do construction. He could do auto repair. He could do, not to, you know, there's that stigma, the voc-ed, as if you're not smart, and I don't believe that that is true, but someone who could do things with his hands that I could never, I mean, I need to call a handyman to stick a suction cup to the wall. Like, I'm not good with my hands. And he was. And seeing that growth and seeing that self-acceptance is what makes teaching really wonderful.
In essence, you're talking about a good listener, an observer, right?
There's just different ways of taking in information. And the school, K-12, really honors sitting still, sitting at a desk, being quiet, reading and writing. And if you're good at those things, you're rewarded for 12 years of your life. And if you're not good at those things, you're demeaned for 12 years of your life. And so I liked to be the kind of teacher who could see it a different way.
And you, Donald, what's your definition of a good teacher?
It's very much, I think, about communicating passion and curiosity, that this matters, that not just the subject you're teaching, the subject you're interested in matters, that education can do something, that school's sort of worthwhile. Because I'm always worried for my students. I teach freshman college students. So I'm always concerned about how much they're paying, if their time is being well spent. If you know, I'm always worried that I'm wasting their time. If you can communicate that, not only is the information worth learning, you're worth giving this information to. You're worth teaching this process. You're worth essentially being invited into the mystery of knowledge and thinking and the life of the mind. And now I'm falling into metaphor and hyperbole a bit. But because, I mean, that's also, I think, why I'm a teacher. I get really excited about ideas. I like thinking. I like reading. I like running into things, not even things, oh, I've never learned about this before, sort of structures of thought I've never thought. Like, I never imagined that kind of idea. That, I think, is one of the key things to being a good teacher.
And you, Paul?
I didn't like most of my teachers, to be honest. I didn't find them to be particularly inspiring. But I did have a few that were eccentric and funny and inspiring. And I'm of the opinion that if you have one teacher like that in the course of your life, it can open up whole universes of thought.
So what teacher are you thinking about?
In graduate school, I had a professor who taught freak studies and Jonathan Swift and Benjamin Franklin. And we went to the Mutter Museum and talked. We had all these interesting discussions about deviations in the human form and you know, different kinds of satire that existed throughout history. And that really kind of blew my mind. And I also had a professor of African studies that changed my life forever. I took 1 month reading books by African authors and reading theory and post-colonial theory by African theorists. And up until that point in my life, I never had any reason to consider the complexity of Africa. And it just goes to show that, you know, 1 week, 1 month, 1 semester in a class where you're exposed to things that you wouldn't have been exposed to in a regular kind of American school system can change your life and instill different level of empathy within you.
What do you remember from your early school? What are the things, a teacher you liked or, you know, what do you remember from that?
I remember two things because I was always good at school. I don't want to say I was a good student. I had a knack for school. And initially I was in Catholic school, then I went to public school. But because I was good at school, they would make me sit next to the quote-unquote bad kids to try to make them better. Like I would rub off on them a bit, which was sort of embarrassing. I didn't want that kind of responsibility. I didn't want to think like oh, I'm here because I'm better than you. Like, maybe you should model yourself after me. And I was someone like, please stop making people look at me. I don't want anyone's attention on me. And then also I would just pick up the tricks that they was like, oh, here's how you get away with it. Here's how you get away with that.
Like what, for instance?
Just sort of talking back, learning how far you can push issues of respecting a teacher, how much you can sort of slack off and ignore what they're saying, like write what you want to in your own notebook. And like, as a little kid, like learning from other kids to claim a bit of autonomy, like essentially laying claim to my own learning a bit. But also that sense of structure and the rules and like imposition of the rules. I remember in high school, when I was 15, I was a sophomore in high school, and my mother died. And so I missed a lot of school that semester. Well, two teachers just made an error on their attendance sheets. They said I wasn't in class a day that I had been in class. And because I was, you know, was good at school, the schools thought I was a good student. When they saw, like, oh, well, you hit the limit of absences and you have these two unexcused absences, but one class on this day and then one class on that day, like, you're not someone who skips classes. It's probably just a paperwork error. If you go talk to these teachers and they take it off, then you'll be fine. Otherwise, you're going to be expelled for the semester. I thought, like, okay, like, I'm, you know, I work hard. I'm, like, these teachers know me. Like, it's not going to be a problem. And I went to one of my teachers, my French instructor. This was the third semester I'd had her. So she's known me for a year and a half. I've worked harder in class. She knows that this was a class that I really like, and it's a foreign language, so it doesn't just come naturally to me. I'm really working hard to do what I can there. And I'd even gone to her home to clean dog waste from her backyard, like, to help her out. Like, I'm not a bad kid. Like, she knows who I am. I said, hi, you have me down as absent for this day, but I was there. And she pulled out her record. Like, nope, says you weren't here. You weren't here. And I was like, they're going to expel me over this. She's like, well, you should have been there. I was like, I've never skipped. Like, which day was this? And she said, it was this day where we did this. I said, I do remember that day. I was there. I saw that movie. I was late because I was helping the professor from the previous class clean up. And she's like, if you were late, I would have the note. She forgot to take the note from me, and it was going to get me expelled. And she seemed so gleeful. Like, she had this look on her face, like, I finally got you. And the reveling in the power she had over me. And, like, I'm a child. I'm 15 years old. I'm just a kid. And she was so excited. She gets to crush this kid. And the other professor, I went, it's like, hey, you had me down as absent. And she was brand new. It was like her first year. They're like, oh, sorry, must have been a mistake. Like, wiped it. I was fine. But it was really transformative. I'm still really upset about it.
What is the worst teacher you can think of?
The worst teacher I can think
and
of.
And I'm going to ask you the same.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say his name.
No, you don't
but
have to.
He seems to be like a character type. He wore a suit jacket to class to teach high school in a public high school. He was very condescending and very pretentious. And you could tell that he didn't really appreciate the people that he was teaching. He wasn't really excited about them. It was obvious that he saw us all as a burden. So he spoke down to us, and there was a real obvious boundary between the master and the student. And when I teach, I try to remove that boundary and reveal my own vulnerabilities and my own fears. And I think students respond to that more because naturally we resist authority figures. You know, so it's hard to get through that boundary and let it go, but it's been good for me to do that.
What is a really bad teacher? Marjorie, your turn.
I was pretty traumatized in second grade. I used to read all the textbooks the first day, so the second day was pretty boring, and on to the end of the year. So I spent a lot of time fidgeting and passing notes because it's really fun. And I got caught passing notes, and surely I'm remembering this incorrectly because we know memory is fallible. But what I remember is being made to stand there, and she told me, passing notes is the worst thing you can do. It's worse than lying. And I just remember crying and her telling me that I'd done the worst thing possible. And then my desk was moved to the corner, and I was there for more than a day. In my memory, it's like months, but she was so mean, so mean.
What do you think her problem was now in retrospect?
Oh, she wanted control of the class, is my guess, and that was her way of doing it, but she may have been bitter. I mean, I was in second grade in 1962, and there really, women could be wives, teachers, nurses, secretaries. That was kind of it. And a lot of women were teaching because they could, you know, it wasn't something they loved. And, you know, so who knows? Who knows?
All right. So transfer to what is a teacher that, if I could tell them, if I could see them now, I would thank them, hug them, kiss them.
Actually, probably David Endicott in junior year. He was teaching us early American literature, so stuff like Pilgrim's Progress, autobiography of Ben Franklin, but really embodying it as well, not just like, okay, here's a text you have to read. They're like, oh, no, here's the place it comes from. Here's what they're responding to. Here's the world they were coming from. And communicating to us that not only was the information important, but us grasping it was important. Our our comprehension was important. Yeah, he was someone, like, even my friends who I talk to now, 20 years later, they're like, yeah, we remember him because he treated us like adults. He said, like, your time's valuable and your time is being spent here, so I'm going to tell you why what we're doing is worth your time.
And you?
Another English teacher, Miss Ford. She was the first teacher to encourage me to explore writing. And I wasn't the most attentive student, but I was a very good writer. And she saw that in her class, and she suggested that I write for the school newspaper, and they gave me a column where I could write about whatever I wanted. And if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have thought to explore that. And now I write books, and I write every day, and I speak in public to classrooms. And, you know, hearing you tell about that teacher reminded me of Miss Ford. I mean, it's very important what she did for me.
So what was the book that became the wow book for you in which, oh, these books are not just assignments, Paul?
Well, outside of school, it was Matilda by Roald Dahl. It's a book about a little genius. And inside of school, it didn't happen until I was much older, but it was Paradise Lost by John Milton. It's a very long poem from the 1600s about the Garden of Eden. And in the text, God and the devil have speaking roles. It's very ambitious and very beautiful. And something clicked when I was studying it that allowed me to read literature from that time, which gives me a lot of joy now.
And you?
I loved books from the minute I could understand language, so it's hard. In school, we'd go to the library and I'd read all the books about women. There were like three, like Molly Pitcher, I think. Oh, man, Louisa May Alcott. I mean, there weren't that many, and I loved those. But I think a little older, and now it's going to be a movie, A Wrinkle in Time. I read that 5 million times. For me, that their family was a little odd, you know, and she was a little quirky, Meg, the main character. And that was very helpful for me to have a quirky misfit role model in my life at that time.
You?
I do remember the curious way just school could ruin books by making them mandatory. So things that I'd read in elementary school and high school, you know, the classics, coming back to them as an adult and being like, oh, wait, this is actually a good book. Like, there's a reason people have been reading Don Quixote for 400, 500 years, because it's really funny and it still applies today. But Shakespeare was one. I had to read Shakespeare in high school, and I hated it. I didn't like the content at all. I was a puritanical little kid, too. So I was like, oh, it's rude, and it's not, like, this isn't clever. And then literally 2 years later, had a teacher. It was a class devoted to Shakespeare that I had to take. I was like, oh, I have to do this again. Who really opened it up, like, no, here's what's going on in Shakespeare. Here's all the layers. Here's all the connections. And it was just like, wow, this is amazing. I love what's happening here. Also, another transform, because I was in school, you know, just after the end of the Cold War. So reading 1984 in the brief period after the Cold War, but before the War on Terror, having a professor say, like, yeah, so initially when people were reading this, they were saying, like, oh, yeah, Big Brother is Stalin. And now, though, we're allowed to read it as a larger metaphor for government control, like this image of, like, other leaders in there. And just that idea that, not that they didn't have permission to read it in other ways before, just the nature of the culture and the ideas that were there made it so that certain ideas couldn't be thought, which is itself kind of Orwellian. But that was amazing to me, that books could transform, even though the text itself never does.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for coming.
You're
I hope
welcome.
You had a good time. I had a great time. Thank you. That was a conversation with Marjorie Winther, Donald Dealey, and Paul Arendt on why they like teaching. I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna, and this is Common Space, a collaboration between WHYY and First Person Arts. Thanks for listening.